say, well, regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Chuck Michelle from the California Rifle and Pistol Association and the Second Amendment Law Center about the Ninth Circuit en banc decision in Duncan versus Bonta, handed down on Friday. This is the case dealing with California's ban on quote-unquote large-capacity magazines. Now, you might recall that California first passed this ban back in the late 80s, but those who had already purchased their magazines were grandfathered in, so they could keep them, right? And then a few years ago, California said, actually, no. Even if you've owned these magazines for decades, you got to get rid of them. You got to move them out of state. You got to turn them into police. You got to destroy them, but you cannot maintain possession of these previously lawful to own magazines. The Ninth Circuit. Before we get to the Ninth Circuit, U.S. District Judge Roger Benitez was the first to hear this case and said, no, these are, in fact, protected. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed, said, no, they're not. This case was GVR'd, went up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court granted cert, vacated the lower court decision, remanded it back down after Bruin, said do over. For some reason, the Ninth Circuit, to play keep away from the Supreme Court, to keep this case out of the hands of the Supreme Court for as long as possible, the Ninth Circuit then kicked this case all the way back down to Judge Benitez's court, even though we kind of knew what Judge Benitez was going to say. There was nothing in Bruin that would have caused him to say, oh, you know what, they are unconstitutional after all. And so he once again ruled that, yes, these are protected by the Second Amendment. And the Ninth Circuit yet again has said, no, they're not. To talk about the specifics of that decision and where we go from here. Again, let's bring in Chuck Michelle, head of the California Rifle and Pistol Association, head of Michelle and Associates, and co-founder of the Second Amendment Law Center. Take a look and a listen. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us on the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you, Cam. Always happy to be here.
So I got to ask, before we get to the Duncan case, yet another Monday, no news on Snope or Ocean State Tactical. Any thoughts?
In light of what happened in Duncan, both of those cases are very important. Ocean State Tactical is a magazine case.
Right.
So they're ahead of Duncan, and if they decided to take it, they could really save us a lot of time and money on litigating Duncan. But I don't know that either of those cases are fully baked, fully developed. Duncan went to trial twice. There was lots of evidence introduced into the record that may not be there in Snopes or Ocean State. So, and that's what the court's been doing lately, even on Second Amendment cases that present a very precise, narrow issue that really it doesn't require a lot of facts because the courts are simply applying the wrong methodology. And that's what needs to happen. The Supreme Court needs to say, you're getting it wrong, fix it, do it right from now on. They could say that in either of those cases, but I think the Supreme Court is nervous about, you know, procedural sideshows that the state might bring up about why the time isn't right, the case is not ripe for being considered by SCOTUS. But Duncan does not have any of those drawbacks. It's just that it's further behind. It'll be a month before we can get there, a month for the or more for the state to respond, than a month for us to reply. We're probably into next session, beginning the first Monday, October, before they would hold a conference. But we're trying to rush it, but I'm not particularly hopeful that we'll be able to get it done that quickly. So we have to wait if we use Duncan, but the Supreme Court could save us all a lot of time with Ocean Tactical.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, though, Ocean State Tactical, that has not been fully decided on the merits, right? This is a interlocutory appeal. Snope, I mean, has been. In fact, again, kind of like Duncan, right? It was decided twice because it was one of those cases that was GVR'd, sent down to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, had the three-judge panel. I guess sit on an opinion for almost a year. Actually, you know, I take it back. Snope was not one of the cases that was GVR'd, I don't think, because the three-judge panel in the Fourth Circuit held oral arguments Well, maybe it was actually December of 2023, I think, or 2022 was when the oral arguments were held. They sat on that decision for like over a year. And then the Fourth Circuit said, actually, we're going to take this case en banc. And they hold oral arguments. They come out and say that, you know, no, these modern sporting rifles are not protected by the Second Amendment because they're dangerously unusual. They're like machine guns. I think that case would be ripe, even if Ocean State is not. But at this point, Chuck, who knows? Maybe they're going to save Snope and just keep it in conference until Duncan gets up there, and they'll take both of those cases sometime next year. I hope that isn't the case, but at this point, who knows?
I mean, I don't know what the perfect case the Supreme Court may be looking for is. I don't think there's a political resistance to taking a case. There may be some political resistance to taking a semi-auto case. There shouldn't be to taking a magazine case. It's a much narrower issue where they could make the same points and establish the same methodology that would then be applied in a full auto, in a semi-auto case. But I mean, this is reading tea leaves. You've got six judges who are ostensibly on our side, but they all have their own little personal peccadilloes when it comes to picking the right case to hear. And so we just have to keep, this is like the Andante test. You have to keep throwing the spaghetti on the wall to see what's going to stick.
Well, I tell you what, instead of reading some tea leaves, let's go read an opinion, something that we know about. And that is the Ninth Circuit en banc opinion in Duncan reversing the lower court decision by Judge Roger Benitez that held, I think you and I would both agree correctly, that magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds are, in fact, protected by the Second Amendment. What was the argument that the Ninth Circuit used to disagree with Judge Benitez?
Well, that magazines. Okay, so remember, there's a two-step test. The first, it's not even a two-step test. The first part is not a test; it's a question. Does the language of the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear means carry, arms. The question now is, what does arms mean? And what the courts are trying to do, and if the conduct that's being, the law that's being challenged is covered by the right to keep and bear arms, then you move to the second test, which is whether or not there is historical law that would indicate that the founding fathers would tolerate the modern day law, and that it has to be a connection there. The law has to be done for a similar reason as the historical law has to be done for a similar reason as the modern day law, and then it has to be done in a similar way, enacted in a similar way. It's the how and why test. Has to be enacted in a similar way as the modern day law. Before you even get to that, though, if the product, the hardware that is being banned is not an arm, then you never shift the burden to the government, and you never have to even find a historical analog. And the courts, some of the anti-2A courts, are taking advantage of this by narrowly reading the word arms. So we've got a ruling that says full autos aren't arms. We've got a ruling that says suppressors aren't arms. And now there's some others. And now we've got the Duncan case saying that magazines are not arms. They're accessory or a gun part. So that's basically a cheat code. It's a way to get out from under having to do the historical analysis and judge the most beautiful thing about this whole opinion. We have seven judges against us, four for us. And one of the judges that ruled for us is Judge Van Dyke.
Mm-hmm.
And he made an unprecedented video supplement, video component of his written dissent, where he actually took out his SIG 320 and took it apart, put it back together again. And as he took it apart, he showed, this is a standard capacity magazine, comes with the gun, 17 rounds. Now we've got to swap in a 10-round magazine. But what is it about this magazine and the interface with the gun? So then he's pointing to a red dot scope. If this is an accessory, then this is an accessory, and you can ban red dot scopes. And then he had a bag full of grips that he put on the table, and he said, what grips am I allowed to put on? Because the whole notion of the court is that a 17-round magazine makes the gun more dangerous. And so it, since it makes the gun more dangerous, it can be banned. Now, never mind, dangerousness is dictated by whether the good guy's holding it or the bad guy's holding it.
Right.
A dangerous gun, a quote-unquote dangerous gun, is not dangerous when a good guy holds it. It's more effective to stop a bad guy who's attacking you or your family because you have more rounds to stop the attacker. And people think, you know, you pull the trigger and you shoot one bullet into a guy and he drops down on the ground. Well, that's not reality. Sometimes, depending on the caliber, especially, the stopping power of a particular round may not, one round may is not enough, often is not enough. Not to mention the misses, even on close quarter gunfights, there's a lot of misses. So you need those extra rounds. Every one of those rounds is a little lifesaver that increases the odds of you surviving an attack, especially if it's by multiple attacks.
I was going to say, not to mention, right, it might not be a one-on-one encounter with a bad guy.
It's all perspective. I mean, it's not dangerous. It's more effective. And so if you can ban certain grips because they give you a better, steadier grip, or you can ban a red dot sight because it makes your aim more precise, where does that end? And he took the gun apart. He showed, can we say you have to downgrade? So basically, when they say you got to use a 10-round magazine, they are downgrading your magazine. Well, what else can they downgrade to make it less dangerous? The grip, the pistol, the trigger mechanism, make it so it's harder to pull. How about you're not allowed to have any sights because we don't want the gun to be accurate. The government doesn't want the gun to be accurate. Or how about a slower racking slide? I mean, every one of these parts could be dictated down by the government if you can dictate down a magazine.
Well,
and the next thing you know, you got a freaking stick with a rubber band.
So is there anything in the Ninth Circuit's decision that would prevent California from passing a law tomorrow that says one round magazines are all you get? If it's not an arm, then I mean, there's no limitation, no. Right?
That's right. That's right. Now Jersey went 7. And that was struck down because it was arbitrary. But that judge does happen to say it was arbitrary. But another judge is going to say, no, one's all you need. Because the key to this is when you get a judge that knows about guns, Judge Benitez in San Diego knows about guns, so he can see through the baloney that the state is making in its argument. Judge McGinnis.
Wait, McGlynn? McGlynn.
McGlynn in Illinois knows about guns. He's talking about, he's up on the bench talking about what George Washington carried. I mean, he knows his guns. And so when they try and say this gun can't do that thing or this gun is dangerous because it does that thing, he's like, no, wait a minute. He can see right through it. And that's the same with Judge Van Dyke. When you get a judge that knows guns, it's much easier for that judge to see through the baloney that the state is trying to use to make its case.
Yeah. Well, and I got to say, I mean, that video that he put out, you know, obviously the majority not happy about the video evidence that he provided. But, you know, I saw Costas Morris, who obviously, you know, very well works with you at Michelle and Associates. You know, he had a comment on Twitter that or X that he'd like to see more of this and even both sides. You know, let's have that majority opinion put out a video in addition to the written opinion. And I got to say, I completely agree, because there are a lot of Americans who are simply not going to sit down and read a 147-page legal opinion, but they'll watch an 18-minute long YouTube video. And this is to me, if nothing else, it's a better way to bring these cases to the American people in a way that they'll understand it. Yeah. But I don't think that was the objection by the court. I don't think they liked that Judge Van Dyke, again, was providing this visual evidence as to why they were so wrong and what this means, not at some 50,000 foot level, not in some vague, you know, legal theory, but what it means to that woman who wants to who needs to protect herself and her children at 3 o'clock in the morning against these three home invaders who are making their way inside her house.
Right. We live in a visual age. You know, especially the younger folks, they are not reading, especially not reading a dense legal opinion that is, that to them is kind of hard to understand. They watch videos, whether it's TikTok or Instagram or X or YouTube, whatever it is, that's where they're at. That's where their heads are at. And I think Judge Van Dyke very brilliantly recognized that and took advantage of it. And I think we're probably going to see more of this in future opinions, not just gun opinions.
But I hope so.
So we're Second Amendment bound. I mean, we're Supreme Court bound. I got to give a hat tip to the NRA for helping to, in part, support this case, the Duncan case, and some other groups too. Second Amendment Foundation, Gun Owners of California have been working with us. So I truly think that this case, unless they dispose of the issue in Ocean State Tactical, I think this case has a 70 to 80% chance of being accepted by the Supreme Court, because it's just a pretty package. It's packaged up very nicely, and the issues are presented in a way that there's not a bunch of sideshows, side issues that have to be resolved. So they can just do a clean ruling on whether magazines are arms, as the term is used in the Second Amendment, and then whether or not there's a historical analog to limit the firepower of a or limit the effectiveness of a firearm by banning parts that make it more effective.
Well,
I think they're going to find that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's the trick, right, for the Ninth Circuit, is if they don't have to wrestle with the historical tradition, then that you know, makes it a heck of a lot easier for them, right? Because we don't have any historical limitations. I mean, when revolvers first came on the market, and so you went from single-shot firearms to multi-shot firearms, correct me if I'm wrong, Chuck, I'm not aware of any state that went back and said, nope, you can't own a revolver because that's too many rounds. I'm not aware of Henry repeating rifles being banned, even though the marketing line was, you know, load on Sunday, shoot all week, right?
Historically, the goal was always to have more rounds, more stopping power, faster reloading. I mean, you know, this is what we evolved from single shot, you know, black powder muskets, which were not particularly effective. So the step-by-step technological advances of firearms manufacturing and development and effectiveness, that was always something that was encouraged. It was encouraged because it made the gun a more effective self-defense tool. Now, the flip side of that is, well, yeah, if the bad guys get a hold of it, they have more power too, but the bad guys always get a hold of it. Whatever's out there, you know, usually their first choice is whichever gun they can steal the easiest.
Right.
But when they get down to actually choosing one, their overwhelming choice is a handgun because it's concealable. But, you know, they know how to enhance a gun, put a better grip on it, do all the things that if whether it's illegal or not, they're still going to do it.
Yeah. And as the Supreme Court said in Heller, just because bad guys use a particular weapon doesn't mean that good guys don't have the right to keep and bear them. You cannot ban an entire class of firearms just because they're the most commonly used firearms in crime. So, you know, we answered that question more than a decade ago. And yet you still got courts like the Ninth Circuit that want to relitigate this issue. All right. So last question, just a question of timing then again. It's going to be a couple of weeks before the cert petition is filed with the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah. First, we have to fight to not have the mandate issued. We want to keep the status quo, which is not so people don't have to start throwing their magazines away.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of little procedural hoops we have to jump through, which we will get through as quickly as possible and then get that cert petition. We had already had one drafted. Partially drafted. We got to tweak it, polish it up, but we'll get it in as soon as possible.
Okay.
And in the meantime, you know, we're still fighting. CRPA is still fighting for CCWs not to be too expensive and not to take too long to get in California. The Second Amendment Law Center is launching amicus brief campaigns in multiple cases. We have the Boland case. We have the May case on sensitive places. We have We have a dozen cases that we're working through the systems, and we're going to keep moving those along too.
Okay. And just real quick, because you mentioned the procedural issues still with Duncan, as of right now, folks who possessed those magazines right before California banned them, they were grandfathered in, they are still able to keep those magazines. Well, now, yeah. Those who bought them during Freedom Week are still able to keep those magazines, right?
And if nothing else, we will be fighting to maintain that status quo while the Supreme Court decides whether to take the case. And I'm very hopeful that we will be able to do that.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, Chuck, again, thank you so much for joining me on the program. CRPA.org, that is the website that you need to pay attention to, not just for the legislative stuff. We talk with Rick Travis here on Kam & Company on a regular basis, but the litigation as well. CRPA does it all.
CRPA has shooting programs, legislative advocacy, full-time legislative advocate in Sacramento, and a robust litigation program, training. We're doing everything to be able to, so people can go pull triggers, enjoy the shooting sports, and maintain their right to be able to enjoy the shooting sports and defend themselves.
Absolutely. CRPA.org. Chuck Michelle, thank you so much for your time today, sir. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Anytime, Cam. Have me back. Love you.
Love you too, man. My thanks to Chuck for joining me on the program. And yes, looking forward to having him back again very soon. I'd like to say as soon as we get some news from snow, but I mean, good Lord, that could be months from now. So hopefully sooner than that. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Sort of as a segue to this. So over the weekend, the New Mexico legislature went out of session. Sine die was noon on Saturday. The Democrat-controlled legislature did not adopt a bill that made it easier to sue gun makers for the actions of criminals. They also did not adopt the gas-operated semi-automatic firearm ban that Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham was quietly pushing behind the scenes. She was not nearly as vocal as she has been in recent years about wanting a semi-auto ban, but she was kind of twisting some arms behind the scenes. Anyway, legislative session ends. There was a shooting in Las Cruces, New Mexico on Friday night, apparently at a street takeover. All handguns, according to police. Every round that was recovered, a handgun round. But the governor already using that to demand a special session for public safety, which would include gun control. Republicans, at least in the Senate, are going along with that. They're calling for a special session as well, which is kind of odd to me because they are the minority in New Mexico, at least in the state Senate and the state House. But they, too, want to see some public safety bills raised, particularly their proposals, which would get tough on violent criminals and not on lawful gun owners. So with that as the background, we've actually got our recidivist report and our armed citizen story, both from the Land of Enchantment. Here's the recidivist report. Deadly hit and run in New Mexico brings juvenile justice challenges into focus. And by challenges, the Associated Press means problems, right? So they report that there was a 12-year-old boy behind the wheel of a stolen car, an 11-year-old in the passenger seat, waving a handgun, as a 15-year-old in the backseat recorded video of what police described as a deliberate hit and run. Again, all this was captured on the phone's camera, right? So the 15-year-old, at least believed to be the 15-year-old, said, just bump him, brah. The 12-year-old driver, and this is like, bump him? And the teen passenger responds, yeah, just bump him. Go like 15, 20. Car ends up hitting a bicyclist on his way to work. Stolen car. Windshield shatters, the Associated Press writes, the car sped away in the pre-dawn hours that May morning. Months passed with no arrest. And then in February of this year, a video of the crash surfaced on social media, and it led police back to an 11-year-old who last June was arrested and placed in custody for a series of break-ins and burglaries in Northeast Albuquerque. Police, according to the AP, also accused the boy of shooting and wounding another teenager, which prompted an investigation that turned up firearms and a bulletproof vest that had been stolen from a police vehicle. But, as they write, the allegations of running down and killing a person were on another level, one seldom dealt with in New Mexico's juvenile justice system. The 11-year-old and the other boys in the car, now 13 and 16, were arrested last week in connection with the death of Scott Dwight Habermel, who's a father of two and an engineer. Prosecutors have said that all three boys will face counts of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, leaving the scene of an accident involving great bodily harm or death, and unlawful possession of a handgun by a person under the age of 19. They're also seeking to have the older teen, who is now 16 years old, charged as an adult. The AP says the spike in juvenile violence, particularly this latest case, has shaken the community, further frustrated law enforcement, and added to the pressure on policymakers to reconsider the limitations of a juvenile justice system that wasn't designed to deal with children as young as 11. They note that Albuquerque police have arrested numerous teens, most being 15 or older, in homicide cases over the last year, but they can't recall a case in which someone as young as 11 has faced a murder charge. The issue, and they kind of broaden this out to talk about, you know, juvenile justice overall, which I have no problem with. We've talked a lot about the problems within the juvenile justice system, particularly when we see these incredibly violent offenses in a system that is designed to rehabilitate whenever possible, right? Not to incarcerate. But what happens when you have a 12, 13, 15-year-old child who has committed an act so heinous that there's no way that individual A, is going to be rehabilitated, or B, is going to be done justice by being released on their 21st birthday, right? And in this case, again, you've got repeat offenders. You've got individuals who are known to the local police, who time and time again are getting arrested for very serious crimes, but are released to their parents or guardian, are sent home on electronic monitoring, are told to show up in court, and then they go on and they commit more crimes while they're out on bond, at the very least. And then oftentimes, again, the sentences that they receive in juvenile court are not nearly as stiff as what they would receive if they were tried as adults. Now, rather than deal with this, and Republicans in New Mexico have proposed several bills this past session that would deal with juvenile offenses, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, again, has taken this approach of, now let's ban our way to safety, right? Now, again, kind of dovetailing off that first story, we've got our armed citizen story from Albuquerque, where the shooting death of a 14-year-old is being investigated as a possible justifiable homicide. And when I say possible, no arrests have been made. It seems like there is a presumption on the part of the Albuquerque Police Department that this was, in fact, an act of lawful self-defense. Happened on Friday night. According to the Albuquerque Police Department, there were several teenagers who were involved in a fight with people at an apartment complex. They say the teens then chased those individuals into an upstairs unit where the fighting continued. Police say one of the teens threw a rock at the unit's window, and one of the residents then fired at the teens, hitting the 14-year-old. The resident told police that children were inside the apartment with them, that they had warned the teenagers that he had a gun as they tried to enter the unit. So this wasn't like somebody downstairs throwing a rock up to the second story. Sounds like they were right there at the window, threw a rock at the window, trying to gain entry. According to, this is, I believe, KRQE in Albuquerque, resident questioned by police was released to the scene, not facing any charges. The 14-year-old unfortunately passed away at the scene. But according to KRQE, police believe the shooting was in self-defense, but they will continue to investigate. And again, you know, I think it is a tragedy that a 14-year-old has lost his life, even if this was a justifiable use of force. And it goes back to, what are the consequences for committing offenses as a juvenile in the state of New Mexico right now? And are those consequences so light, either in terms of being arrested in the first place, or what happens after you are formally charged, and what happens after you appear in court and you are adjudicated? Are those consequences so light that it is essentially encouraging juveniles to go out and commit more crimes because they feel like they will be untouched by the law? Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a good Samaritan out in California helped a man who had been trapped in his pickup truck for nearly 24 hours earlier this month. Daniel Higginbottom was almost home back on March the 4th when he lost control of his truck in Sierra County, California. He said, I was five miles from home. He said, I looked down at my phone real quick, and before I knew it, I was airborne. He said, when I came to, I was basically upside down in my truck. And by the way, I mean, that is a cautionary tale right there, right? You can think, hey, I got a straight road ahead. Hey, there's no traffic. I'm just going to glance at my phone. All it takes is that one instant. your eyes are off the road, you go off the road too, and then you end up hopefully not like Mr. Higginbottom. His truck ended up crashing about 30 feet down an embankment. He's hanging sideways. He's in excruciating pain. He's got blood running to his head. He's got a crushed leg pinned under the steering wheel. He can't get out of his truck. And he had no way to call for help because his phone that he was looking at flew out of his hand in the crash. So he can't dig it out of his pocket or anything. He said, I fought it for a couple of hours, and then I realized I was stuck and I wasn't going to get out. Now, Higginbottom's dog, Junior, was in the truck and survived without injury, amazingly enough. He managed to climb out the window, but he's hanging out by the truck. He's not leaving Higginbottom's side. It's almost impossible for anybody on the road to see the truck because he's 30 feet down that embankment. He spent about 22 hours in that precarious position, wondering that if he was going to be rescued. He said he would bang on the door panel, just make as much noise, say help, screaming help. He said, but nobody heard me. He said, the only thing that kept me going was just thinking about my daughter. There was a cold, snowy night that he survived. But he said that next morning he had lost hope. He thought that that's where he was going to die. And then a driver on the highway just happened to notice the truck and called 911. And then not long afterwards, according to KOVR, emergency crews arrived on the scene. He said at that point, once the jaws of life were used and a pulley system to get him up out of the embankment, he said, at that point, I realized it wasn't a dream. I got saved. He said, I'm kind of still in shock that somebody actually found me. He also gives credit to his dog, Junior, because when he heard somebody yell out, is anybody there? He said he started screaming, get him, Junior, to my dog. He said, I heard him bark. I could tell that he was running. So Junior ran up the embankment to where the crew was and then took him back down the embankment so they could see where Higginbottom was stuck in the truck. Higginbottom ended up having to have his right leg amputated from the knee down because of frostbite. Also had frostbite on a number of fingers and toes, but he says he's dealing with it very well because, quote, I'm still alive. He said, I don't think it's going to slow me down after I actually heal up. I will be all right. So, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need, that Good Samaritan, who somewhat miraculously came across the Daniel Higginbottom's truck 30 feet down an embankment, at least saw something was wrong and had the presence of mind to call 911 and to save a life that, quite frankly, in just a few hours would have been lost. So don't know the name of that Good Samaritan, by the way. Apparently he just continued on his way, but in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again soon. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member as well. Just use the promo code FIGHT. You can get 60% off your membership. You'll get exclusive content and other goodies no matter what tier you join. But you'll also be supporting the independent pro Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms, and we greatly appreciate that support. So thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your Monday, as good as Mondays can be enjoyed. We'll see you back here again soon. And again, until then, be well, be safe, and be free.